It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream.
Welcome to the Lars Larson Show on this Martin Luther King holiday. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, honestly provocative talk on the issues of the day for the Pacific Northwest. I know that many of you may think of MLK Day as a holiday associated with liberals, but I think that's the wrong way to think of it.
It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yeah. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream.
As I said, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to take your phone calls and your emails. I wanted to say a few things about Martin Luther King. And I know that there are conservatives, even conservative friends of mine, who say, Martin Luther King Day, I don't think it should be a holiday. They have various different points of view. I think of it differently. Martin Luther King Jr. was a conservative American, and I think he should be remembered that way. And if you say to me, but Lars, when I watch the specials on MLK, they don't mention him being a conservative. Well, that's because you're watching them on conventional, traditional media, and most of it is inherently liberal. Let me make the case. Martin Luther King was a man of faith, like so many American conservatives today. Liberals, not so much when it comes to faith. As a man of the cloth, he undoubtedly believed in the right to life of unborn babies. And that alone would have had MLK kicked right out of today's Democrat Party, because today's Democrat Party celebrates, even venerates, the so-called right to choose. Do you know that Planned Parenthood actually has Christmas cards? Christmas, a holiday about the birth of Jesus Christ, and they have cards that say, peace on earth, except they say choice on earth. They mean the right to kill babies, and they somehow associate that with Christmas. We choose life, and so did Dr. King. Dr. King was surveilled by the FBI and other government agencies during his civil rights crusade, just as many conservatives are today surveilled by the government. Even a president, like Donald Trump, surveilled by the government. So we have that in common with Dr. King if you need a point of common cause. The Montgomery bus boycott, that was actually the historical event that triggered the rise of MLK from a community pastor to a nationwide leader for civil rights. It was significant enough to the United States that we have a national holiday in his honor. But remember what that boycott was all about. Again, you've had the mainstream media version of the bus boycott. You remember that black Americans were told to ride in the back of the bus. Let me add something to that. Nearly all the private bus companies in the United States took all customers without regard for color. I'll bet you've never heard that before. It was the government-run bus transit agencies that made some Americans sit in the back because of their skin color. The next time you see an MLK story, maybe even on MLK Day, and you see it on local television, and they say, well, the bus companies made black Americans sit in the back of the bus, you ought to call their newsroom and say, are you aware? The private bus companies, all they cared about was customers and serving them. They didn't care about skin color. It was the government-run transit agencies that actually committed that offense against Rosa Parks and others. Dr. King believed in what the founders of this country set out to do, a country where all were equal in the eyes of the law. Here's one of my favorite quotes from Dr. King. We will reach the goal of freedom in Birmingham and all over the nation because the goal of America is freedom. Now, he didn't say freedom just for black citizens of this country. He just said freedom. And that was the other thing. I mean, to a large extent, while his civil rights crusade was about the rights specifically of black Americans, he didn't see us as black Americans and white Americans. He saw us as all Americans. every conservative in America could embrace that same goal that Dr. King spoke of from Birmingham jail. In fact, in the famous I Have a Dream speech that you heard at the beginning of this segment, King also spoke of the Constitution as a contract with Americans. And I think that's a great way to look at it. One that he had come to Washington, D.C. to see enforced, because the Constitution is a guarantee. Think of that in terms of Americans and conservatives, a contract that guarantees to limit the scope of government and deliver the maximum amount of liberty to every American citizen. That's something that conservatives embrace, and so did Dr. King, because the way he looked at it, there's this contract. It includes all Americans, and the original goal of the founders, while some of them owned slaves, that's true, but the original goal of the founders was that all Americans would be considered equal. The fact that it was an aspirational goal, meaning one you haven't actually achieved yet, but you hope to get there someday, I think that's exactly what King wanted. He came to D.C. and he said, listen, we have a contract. Our black American citizens are full citizens and they have constitutional rights. And if the contract is being enforced for some parts, some of the people involved in the contract, but not all, that's just wrong. Where the political left today wants to see everything in terms of identity, either racial identity, religious identity, sexuality, and these days even your gender, to determine who you are and what you will get from the government based on that racial identity. I think Dr. Martin Luther King never would have embraced that idea, because he lived at a time when the color of your skin defined you, and dark skin meant that you were somehow less of a full citizen. I think he would automatically reject the idea of identity politics, that somehow the color of your skin entitles you to either greater or lesser benefits from the government. I think that Dr. King would have rejected today's identity politics in a heartbeat. Some folks argue that Dr. King never identified specifically as a Republican or a Democrat, but I would argue that his actions and his words made him a conservative Republican at heart. Think about what the Republican Party stood for and what the Democrats stood for. The Republican Party founded almost 175 years ago as an anti-slavery party. Democrats, on the other hand, supported slavery, including the first Democrat president, the execrable Andrew Jackson. Democrats fought to keep blacks in slavery and passed discriminatory black codes and Jim Crow laws. The Democrats started the Ku Klux Klan to lynch and terrorize black Americans. The Democrats fought to prevent the passage of every civil rights law, beginning with the civil rights laws of the 1860s and continuing on to the civil rights laws of the 50s and 60s. As for the Republican Party, yeah, I'm not happy with the party itself these days, but that's not about its history. A political party that expects to accomplish a lot has to stick its neck out. So let me tell you a little bit about Republicans. 150 years ago or so, the Emancipation Proclamation from a Republican president, the end of the Civil War, and less than a decade later, the right to vote for women from an amendment written by a Republican, Susan B. Anthony, and introduced in Congress by Republican Senator Aaron Sargent. No, I think today you should remember this is a great day because it's Martin Luther King Day. And Martin Luther King Day, at the end of the day, was a great conservative American. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails. We'll do that a bit later. I wanted to go back, just mentally go back to January of 2020, and we saw the first indications that an epidemic that had started in Wuhan, China, was going to come to the United States, and it was almost inevitably going to come. The question was, how big was it going to be, and how hard was it going to hit us? And I don't think anybody, all of the various experts I interviewed at the time in late January, even early February, had no idea the kind of damage that it could do. But I remember being the happy warrior I am most days and saying, you know what, this looks like one of those V-shaped recoveries. I don't have a degree in economics, but we're going into it fast. We ought to come out of it fast. And we seem to be doing that in the early fall, late summer, early fall of 2020. But now who knows where we're going to be going? So I thought it would be especially appropriate to talk to James Rickards, who's just authored The New Great Depression, Winners and Losers in a Post-Pandemic World. Mr. Rickards, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lars. Great to be with you.
I had congratulated on you on your dual law degrees, one in just plain law, JD, and one in tax law. And you've got some great experience going all the way back, as you mentioned, to Citibank. First of all, before we get to the new Great Depression, when do we get to the post-pandemic world? Are we there now, or is it still some time away?
It's still some time away, and that's unfortunate. And you gave a very good capsule description, Lars. So yeah, last spring, this thing hit. It was worse than people expected. The initial thought was that, and I talk about this in my book. The initial thought was it was contained in China. They've got it might be bad there, but they've got it under control. We don't have to worry about it. And then the stock market started to crash the day that they got Italian data. The Chinese were lying about everything. So even though it was bad, we couldn't really trust the data. But the Italians were telling the truth. And when it began to grow exponentially in Italy, that's when Wall Street crashed. And that lasted about a month till the end of March. And then we saw what happened, you know, in March, April, and May. We were all kind of locked down, quarantined. Businesses were closed, et cetera. But there was a sense that, you know, by the summer, or, you know, as you say, or the fall, things would be better. We could, you know, the great reopening, all these businesses would reopen. They tried that, and the disease just got worse. Now, right now, we're going into a second recession in the Great Depression. I make the distinction between a recession, which is very technically defined, two or more consecutive quarters of declining GDP, and a depression, which lasts much longer. You can have growth in a depression, but it's below trend growth. You never get back to trend. And certainly the debt is growing faster than the economy, so you're getting into a deeper and deeper hole. That's where we're in. They last for a very long time. But even having said that, we're right now going into a second recession, technical recession, in the depression. And the reason for that, and this goes to your question about the pandemic, right now it's not twice as bad or three times as bad. It's almost 10 times as bad as what we had last spring, believe it or not. If you look at, you just go to the Johns Hopkins coronavirus dashboard, very reliable data, the case load and the fatalities are almost 10 times greater than they were last spring. And so, and that's bad just from a medical point of view, obviously, and the fatalities are going up steeply. But what are the governors and the mayors doing? They're shutting down the economy again, which, you know, another round of lockdowns. By the way, lockdowns don't work. I can explain why that's
true. I wanted you to get to that. I'm talking to James Rickards, who's the author of, I want to make sure people get credit, The New Great Depression, Winners and Losers in the Post-Pandemic World. So I wanted to ask you about that. Do these lockdowns do any good? Because at the beginning, I was one of those saying, yeah, it's probably smarter for people to stay home for a while till we figure this out. We figured a lot of it out. And haven't we figured out at this point lockdowns don't work, but we're seeing them be imposed anyway?
That's correct. And by the way, there was some evidence last spring. I started writing the book in late April, May, and kind of continued through the summer. There's some evidence then that lockdowns don't work. But you could kind of give officials the benefit of the doubt, say, well, we're really not sure. Maybe you have to do this. But today, that argument doesn't stand up at all because we have a lot more data. So we had, in the United States, we never had a national lockdown. We had 50 separate state lockdowns. You know, some were worse than others. New York, Michigan, California, some other states were extreme. South Dakota never had a lockdown. That was it was just voluntary. So you kind of got like 50 separate experiments. And then around the world, you had places like South Korea, which had an extreme form of lockdown. Sweden had kind of a moderate form of lockdown, not quite as extreme, and some places didn't lock down at all. So anyway, we now have all that data. And what it shows is whether you were extreme, moderate, or not at all, had no material impact on your caseload or your fatalities. They had the same experience with the virus, which means that lockdowns do not stop the spread of the virus, because no matter what policy people had, they had the same results. So there's your evidence that lockdowns don't work, but they do destroy the economy. That's clear. So here we are again. The pandemic's worse. The lockdowns are back. You know, again, the same places, New York, California, and elsewhere. They're not going to stop the spread of the virus. I mean, ask yourself, if we had lockdowns and the virus and the fatalities are 10 times worse, isn't that evidence that lockdowns don't work? I mean,
I would say so. And I'm glad you brought up Sweden, because I have some Swedish ancestry. But, people give me a hard time to say, well, Sweden worked. And I said, well, they had kind of a modified lockdown. You're just saying, oh, they went on as usual. And I said, no, they didn't. If you actually look at what they did, and I've gone over and read the Swedish papers. I don't read the language, but Google's great for translating. And they did slap down, you know, pretty hard, although not as hard as their neighbors. And their neighbors had, to some extent, an easier go of it. But the other thing that's changed, we know more about the disease and how to treat it. And we also know that it's perhaps not as contagious as it was once feared to be, didn't spread as fast, and wasn't and isn't as deadly as we first were told by the medical experts back then. So why is it? I mean, for people like me, Mr. Rickards, I'm a conservative. We look at it and we say, gee, the blue states are locking down, the red states are not. It's a pretty easy equation. Am I looking at that too simplistically, or is this all about, is this mostly about politics and not about science or medicine?
Well, unfortunately, both factors come into play. So one of the things I say in my book is that the virus is not a Republican or a Democrat. The virus just wants to kill you. So that's all you need to know. The virus wants to kill you. So take the politics out of your appraisal of the pandemic. Having said that, you're correct that this has been heavily politicized, and people took different paths based on their political views. And initially, Governor DeSantis in Florida took a moderate approach, not extreme at all. And then Florida had a spike in July and August. They said, see, it doesn't work. Well, guess what? We have more data now. Florida's doing fine. They're way ahead of the rest of the country.
And they're doing a better job on vaccine distribution as well. Sorry correct. To throw that in.
Well, that's another very good point. So it was, I think, miracle is the right word to describe how quickly the pharmaceutical industry came up with the vaccine. 8 months. Nobody thought they could do that, but they did. And then you had to get it out there. So the White House picked a 3-star general who's like a logistical genius, and he actually took over the U.S. Postal Service to get the vaccine delivered. A lot of people were complaining, oh, gee, my Christmas cards arrived a week late. Well, they did, because they used the Postal Service to get the vaccine up. So they got it to the point of injection, but that's where it's breaking down. In the public health system, the hospitals and the clinics, they can't actually get it injected fast enough, and they're starting to throw away doses. New York's the worst. For example, this vaccine has to be kept about 100 degrees below zero.
Yep.
Until it gets to the point of use, then you defrost it or thaw it out. But at that point, it's like a quart of milk.
I'm talking to James Rickards, 2 law degrees, 1 in tax law, but the author most recently of The New Great Depression, Winners and Losers in a Post-Pandemic World. We'll be back in just a moment, and I'll get to your calls and your emails later. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. My guest, and I've been so anxious to talk to him, or looking forward to it, James Rickards, who's the author of The New Great Depression, Winners and Losers in a Post-Pandemic World. He has a history in tax law and also in working for some fairly large financial institutions, so he knows his stuff. You left off by describing, here's New York, the vaccine doses delivered, and then as usual, and from my point of view, the government being completely inefficient, couldn't run a popsicle stand. They can't seem to get the vaccine to the people who need it, and it's literally going to waste. Where do we pick up from there?
Well, first of all, that's exactly right. But beyond that, you mentioned earlier that it was maybe not as contagious as we thought. Well, the contagion data has moved up and down because we had more testing and found out, more about the population generally, although it is contagious enough. But there's a new strain. It's here. It came out of, first identified in England and South Africa, so call it the English strain if you want to. It's now in the United States. It's going worldwide. You can't stop it. That is much more contagious than what's called the Italian strain. The Italian strain, which came out of Milan, it all started in China. I mean, don't get me wrong. It all started in Wuhan, China, but it spread east and west, and it went west into Milan for Fashion Week, and then it came from Italy to New York, and then spread around the rest of the country. So that's the Italian strain. But now we have this English strain, which is more contagious. So we have data on that. That's clear. And with more contagion come more fatalities. The fatality rate isn't necessarily higher. It's too soon to tell. But the number of fatalities is higher because the number of cases is higher. Yes, treatments are better. We've learned that ventilators don't work. The ventilators are good for certain things, but not for this. The people were dying from the ventilators. But what you need is oxygen, which is different. You don't need a pump. You just need pure oxygen into your lungs, and then you can still breathe. The other thing, this is a mutation, and some mutations are harmless. It's a part of the genome that doesn't affect the spread of the virus, but some mutations are extremely dangerous. They make the contagion rate higher and can make the fatality rate higher. But the bigger question is, does the new mutation, is that still subject to the vaccine? Does the vaccine work against the new mutation? Too soon to tell. Hopefully the vaccines still work. But the virus, as I say, just wants to kill you. So the virus continually mutates, and there's something called mutation escape. And that's when it mutates in such a way that the vaccine does not work, or if you've recovered, the antibodies don't work. That's the most dangerous of all. That has happened in past pandemics. It happened in the Spanish flu of 1918. The second wave was far worse than the first wave. And they didn't even have a vaccine then, but they were still, as I said, subject to these mutations that made it worse. So we've got that confronting us, and we're heading into another recession within the Depression because of the lockdown policies. So it's hard to see this getting better until, I mean, at the earliest, best case, late 2021, early 2022.
Wow. But I'm talking to James Rickards. Mr. Rickards, he's the author most recently of The New Great Depression, Winners and Losers in a Post-Pandemic World. I did intend to circle back to the economic side of this, but is anybody making the case, do you think, that you're making to the people who make decisions, like Governor Cuomo, Governor Newsom of California? They don't have to do it to Ron DeSantis. He seems to understand it already. But to start to tell these states, I understand it's a state-level decision, and yet nobody seems to be effectively making the case, hey, start the economy back up. Get it going as much as you can. Protect the people who need to be protected. Get them the regular routine treatments, remdesivir, whether it's the monoclonal antibodies, which I guess are going begging now. They're overproduced at this point. But get the economy going, because especially with a pandemic still going or still a problem, we got to generate the income and the wealth that actually pays for all of this stuff.
Yeah, there is a group making that case, and it's a powerful group. It's doctors, clinicians, professors of medicine, immunologists, epidemiologists. There's something called the Great Barrington Declaration. You can Google it. Just Google, Great Barrington Declaration. You'll find it right away. And a group put it together and published it, but they invited their colleagues to sign on. Like, you could just sign your name up and say, yeah, I agree with this. Thousands of doctors and, again, experts have signed on to this. It was started by a group, one of whom is a professor of medicine at Stanford University. So this is not some, fringe political group or whatever. These are the top people. They know a lot more than Dr. Fauci, believe me. So that's out there. But the question is it getting through to the politicians? I mean, again, it's powerful science, and I've cited some of it, and this Great Barrington Declaration has more. There are new studies coming out all the time that say the same thing. But try doing it on Twitter or Facebook. You'll get censored. You'll get canceled. They'll put a sticker on your tweet, because somehow you're not following the science. Well, you are following the science. It's just not the science that they want. They want the lockdown science, which is very thin and very weak. So the politicians don't know any better. They're doing what the politicians have to be seen to be doing something, even though they don't know what they're doing, which is correct. They just want to do something for show. Andrew Cuomo, Gretchen Whitmer, Gavin Newsom, all these governors all over the country are putting on a show, but they don't know what they're talking about. They're relying on a small sliver. Lars, the old saying, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Well, yeah.
if you're an immunologist, everything looks like a lockdown. And Fauci's an over-the-hill bureaucrat, immunologist. Everyone's like, he's the great immunologist. No, he's not. Yeah, he's got the degree. I'll grant that. But there's no way he's on the cutting edge of science. You do have to go to the Rockefeller Institute or Johns Hopkins or Harvard or Stanford to find people who really understand what we're talking about. And so I wish I had a better prognosis, but what we know, again, this is hard data. There's a new strain. It's more contagious. Fatalities are going up. It's far worse than it was last spring. The vaccines are out there, but they're bungling the injections. And it's not clear that the virus won't mutate around it, and lockdowns don't work. So that's a pretty dire scenario. But I tell people, I'm not an optimist, I'm not a pessimist, I'm a realist, and I'm an analyst. I look at what's actually going on. And that's what we're telling people in the book. You can't necessarily solve all the problems of the world, but if you can just shine a light on it and explain it to people, they take a lot of comfort from that.
Mr. Rickards, that's what I try to do with this show. And I got to tell you something. I used to work in television a long time ago as a reporter. I started in radio, and then I went to television and came back to for talk radio. But at the time, I would talk to our engineers and say, why aren't we buying that new gear? And they say, we're going to let these other guys try it first and see how it works out over there at the bigger markets where they got more money to spend. And then we'll see how it works out, and then we'll buy it. For the life of me, I can't understand why cities and counties, especially the state health divisions and the county health divisions, aren't looking around the landscape saying, maybe we're not doing it the right way. And I think it's ego. They all belong to these associations like Association of Counties, Association of Cities, and they spend tons of money on junkets to fly to these meetings. And I think if they looked at, and I'll give you the great example to beat New York up with, one of the poorest states in America, notoriously, West Virginia. Do you know what their effective delivery rate is right now? About 70% on vaccine. And you go, well, how the heck did they do that? Did they reinvent the wheel or something? No. They went to all the pharmacies. They got their National Guard up. And they said, let's have the pharmacies start giving shots. And all of a sudden, they're using 70% of what's being delivered. And who knows, that may grow to, you know, even better. I mean, ideally, you'd have the stuff in people's arms so fast that you'd be waiting for the next statement, next shipment, instead of the other way around. Meanwhile, a lot of the blue states are down around the 25 or 30% mark. Abysmal failure. And I can't believe the people in those bureaucracies don't say, is anybody doing it better by the numbers? Oh, West Virginia is? What are they doing? Okay, let's do it that way here. I mean, imitation's the sincerest form of flattery, right?
Yeah, that's right. And by the way, West Virginia, you're right, they're doing a much better job of distributing the vaccine. But even before the vaccine, they had one of the lowest fatality counts in the country. They were like second or third from the bottom of the 50 states, which is where you want to be. They had the fewest fatalities.
Absolutely. The book is called The New Great Depression, Winners and Losers in a Post-Pandemic World. We'll talk the economic side of this in just a moment. I'm talking to James Rickards, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I will get to your calls a bit later at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can tell your Alexa device, play the Lars Larson Show. You'll be amazed how that works. And of course, there's streams and podcasts and everything else. Just find them at LarsLarson.com, spelled with an O-N the way God intended. My guest is James Rickards, the author most recently of The New Great Depression, Winners and Losers in the Post-Pandemic World. We've talked a lot about medicine and vaccines and the China virus. By the way, you said it's the English virus. I've been told for the last 12 months that calling it the China virus makes me a racist. I guess calling it the English virus also makes you a racist, too. So we see how turnaround is fair play. About the economics of this and how this country is going to come out of it. We all wish that the politicians would do what you're suggesting is get the economy going again, treat the disease, shelter the vulnerable, and let's get on with it. But given the way things are going and assuming we don't see gigantic change from the politicians who are actually making the decisions, most of them at the state level, what's the average person to do? And how do they best respond to this challenge that's going to be an economic challenge for many Americans, including me?
Well, first of all, Lars, and again, apart from the lockdown, we talked about the lockdown, so we kind of move on from there. So what is the government doing? Well, since in the past year, since the pandemic really started to spread, the Federal Reserve has printed $3 trillion, not billion, but trillion. And the federal government, the Congress, has approved $4 trillion of new deficit spending. Now, that's on top of the existing deficit, which never went away. But they put $4 trillion on top of that. And in the early weeks of the incoming Biden administration, they're going to do another deal, a bill. They'll probably put $2 trillion more on top of that, including these $2,000 checks they're going to hand out. So people go, well, if the Fed printed $3 trillion and the Congress spent $6 trillion, we're going to get all this stimulus. No, you are getting the money printing. And you are getting the deficit spending, but none of it is stimulus. And I explain why in Chapter 4 of the book. So money printing, the Austrians and the monetarists, the neo-Keynesians, they say, well, you print all that money, you're going to get inflation. No, printing money does not cause inflation. What does cause inflation is borrowing and spending and lending. And it's called velocity. It's the turnover of money. So the Fed balance sheet right now is about $7 trillion. But I remind people, $7 trillion times zero is zero. In other words, if you don't have turnover, if you don't have velocity, you don't have an economy. And that's the problem. So how does the Fed print money? Well, the way they do it, they buy treasury notes from the big banks,
yep.
and they pay for them with money that comes out
of
thin air.
Yep.
But what are what do the banks do with the money? They give it back to the Fed in the form of deposits at the Fed and excess reserves. In other words, that money is trapped between the Fed and the big banks, but it's not getting out into the real economy because there's no borrowing, lending, and spending. Now, let's take the deficit spending. Well, surely you spend $4 trillion. That'll stimulate the economy. No, and the reason is, you know, you hand out these $2,000 checks to everybody, which, you know, that is coming. We can see that coming. But people are taking the money. They're either paying off debt or paying their liabilities, you know, like rent or, you know, a loan of some kind, or they're saving it. They're not spending it. Our economy is 70% consumption. The checks are going out the door, but people are not spending it. And the economists actually call this a precautionary savings. So if you're unemployed, you're definitely going to save it because, you know, you got to pay next month's rent. Even if you're not unemployed, you're going to save it because you're like, well, maybe your spouse got laid off. Maybe your neighbor got laid off. Or you're saying to yourself, how do I know I'm not going to get fired next week? So I'll save it just in case. Well, that can be a smart individual decision. I'm not against savings. As I say, it can be very smart. But in the aggregate, if everyone does it, and they are, you don't get the spending. No one's taking a $2,000 check and running out and buying a new car or refrigerator or, you know, a carpet or anything. They're sticking it in the bank, which is smart. But there's no consumption. So they are doing these things. The Fed can print money, and the government and the Congress can deficit spend. But don't call it stimulus because it has no stimulative effect.
Well, and it can't. How does it stimulate an economy if people are choosing to save it or pay down debt or pay their regular bills with it, but they're not buying those things? Then that doesn't stimulate the production of new wealth or the production of goods and services that are then purchased
Correct.
By people. And actually, I saw middle of last year, I started seeing the savings rates go up, which I thought was good. It was sensible against bad times. But how do we then change that? And having been through this shock with no idea of where the end is, as we say, the post-pandemic world, when does it begin? That when people say, I don't know when it's going to begin, so I better have a stockpile of money available for my family to make sure our needs are taken care of. Once it does start to end, and it won't end like flipping a light switch, how do we get them back to saying, okay, let's go back to being the consumptive economy we used to be?
Right. There's only one way to do it, and I talk about this in Chapter 6 and the conclusion of my book. So you have to, and it's not money printing or deficit spending, it's psychological. You have to change inflationary expectations. We actually need inflation. That's a very unpopular thing to say. Everyone says, oh, I hate inflation. You know, well, inflation has some bad effects, but we need it because we have to reduce the real value of the debt. We have to get people spending again. So you have to change the psychology. The Fed does not know how to do it. The Congress does not know how to do it. I know how to do it, and some others do. It's in the book, and you can do it, you know, for your personal account. Here's how you do it. You've got to raise the dollar price of gold. You know, as soon as you use the G word, as soon as you say gold, everyone's like, oh, you're a gold nut, or you're nothing. Anderson. Fine, I'm used to that. But the fact is it has a long monetary history, and two presidents in the 20th century did it successfully. Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1933 and Richard Nixon in 1971.
Mr. Rickards, it's a pleasure to speak with you. His book is called The New Great Depression, Winners and Losers in a Post-Pandemic World. Be well, and I hope 2021 is better for you than 2020 has been for the rest of us, Mr. Rickards.
Thanks, Lars.
Take care now. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's 2021, a brand new year, and lots of older problems. I always admit if I have a dog in the fight, and I've told you that so that you know that if I've got a personal interest in something we're talking about, that I let you know what my dog in the fight is. I know some people don't like that metaphor. But about 5 years ago, I found out that I have type 2 diabetes. Now, I haven't actually found it to be that big of an impact on my life, although I certainly eat a lot healthier these days than I did more than 5 years ago. And I've told people that, you know, you can handle it. Type 2 is easy. Type 1, that's the one where you have to inject insulin. That can be a lot tougher. But I have said that if one day they figure out how to grow a pancreas, I want to buy one the size of a kielbasa so that I can go back to having the kind of breakfast I used to have. On that note, I thought it was really nice to hear that there's some new research out there from here in the Pacific Northwest. Dr. Natalia Shulzinko is involved in that. She's both an MD and a PhD, an associate professor of biomedical sciences, and she joins me on the phone line right now. Dr. Shulzinko, Is it true that if I change the bacteria in my gut, what you doctors call the gut, that I might be able to get rid of much of my type 2 diabetes?
Hello, thank you for having me. Yes, it's possible. At least we see it's possible in mice. People are trying now to do it also in humans, and the results are still, we still need to do more and understand better what's going on there. But we hope in future, that could be one of the additional or new therapies, in type 2 diabetes.
Dr. Shulzenko, I'm reminded, and maybe it's not an appropriate comparison, but I'm reminded there was a time where people thought if you have an ulcer, it comes from either stress or spicy food or a little bit of both. And then they found out there was a bacteria in your gut that was actually causing it. Once you take care of that bacteria, a great many ulcers were effectively cured. Is it right to think of it that way, that the stuff living in your stomach and everything below, all the piping below your stomach, has an effect on how you uptake sugar, and you might be able to address people's diabetes that way?
Yeah, that's a perfect example of a bacteria inducing cancer. Here we have now at this time, what I should say is this time we know much more about normal. Which is hard to define what's exactly normal bacteria living within us, on us, but we know much more now thanks to all the molecular tools. So, yes, we are, many researchers are now thinking that a lot of diseases that are traditionally thought to be non-communicable, non-transmissible, might have a bacterial, microbial component. It doesn't mean that you easily transmit it to, your family member, the type 2 diabetes, for example. But maybe we can use it as a handle to change the disease and to do a little bit better in terms of people's, health. So, yes, I think that's a really good example. And so as I said, we need to do more.
Dr. Shulzenko says, does this mean at some point, in the case of the pylobacter, the stuff that was making ulcers, that was where you had the wrong kind of bacteria there and you had to get rid of it. In this case, as I understand it, your research that's going to be published, I think, in Nature, that it's showing that if you could add some more of the favorable kind of bacteria, that your body would be able to better handle the sugars that you in the food that you eat. Is that and so someday it might just be a pill that has some additional bacteria like this?
Exactly. Yes. So the article was published today in Nature Communications, and what we did in that study, we found, and again studying with mice, that when we fed them the bad sort of unhealthy diets, then there were changes in the microbiome. And some of those were important in kind of contributing to the disease. Others were trying to kind of counterbalance it. So we delved into more details into these good guys, because we thought that would be really plausible to use them as future kind of new probiotics, because you can view it as, we know that the market of probiotics is just of the counter products, but it's hard to say which ones are really that effective and to whom as well. So we think that this kind of now with these molecular tools that we have and the novel computational approaches, we're able to find new probiotics and that can be then used as a kind of complementary treatments or even for healthy people to boost their health. In this case, we're talking about type 2 diabetes, and what we found was that the liver effects on the liver were really significant. And as you probably know, the liver is really our metabolic hub, and how healthy it is, it's very important. So even if you don't have a disease, you may want to boost the liver health. So in any case, yes, we think that we can design much better probiotics in near future, really, I think, than what we have now traditionally. In theory, yes, it could be, and right now there are clinical trials, not with this strain of the bacteria that we've discovered for type 2 diabetes, again, because there are many, many, many different bacterial strains, and it's hard really for researchers to test all of them to find out which ones are more effective. So those clinical trials, like you said, testing in people, they, you know, or people buying it, it's easy to push it to the market, but we don't want to push it right away because we want to know a little bit more and to have it tested also in people, not just in this mouse settings. And I think we have there are avenues for that to do it in the, as I said, I think next 5 years will be really kind of revolutionary for the probiotics field in terms of that we will know much better what they do. In this study, we found what kind of, it's not just bacteria, it's not, you know, bacteria is one thing, but what they do actually, what we found, that they increase sort of certain antioxidant molecules in the body of mice, in the liver, and systemically, in the blood, basically. So that's also important, so that we can move from bacteria, but also to certain compounds that they produce and make a pill or supplement it that way. And this research is easy to do overall in clinical trials, and I think this is what where we need to go now.
Well, if you need a volunteer doctor, I'll be glad to sign up. It sounds like the kind of thing that adding a few more, if I've already got 10 trillion bacteria in my gut already, 1,000 different bacterial species, what the heck? A little more of one or the other is probably not going to do me any harm. Dr. Shelzenko, thank you very much. I appreciate the time. That's Dr. Natalia Shelzenko, MD and PhD at Oregon State University, talking about the fact that they may have figured out that a different kind of bacteria or more of the good stuff in your gut might actually help you handle type 2 diabetes and sugar and all and being overweight and all that good stuff. Dr. Shelzenko, thank you very much. I appreciate the time. Glad to have you with me. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-439-5277. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. I thought we'd talk a bit about the United States military. You may have heard word that President Trump is going to do his best to make sure that all the troops are home from Afghanistan, perhaps others brought home too, because he promised to get us out of foreign entanglements and foreign wars. So some of you might be wondering, well, how is the United States military doing these days? I thought we'd talk about that with Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, who served America for 2 decades in the U.S. Marine Corps and is a senior research fellow for defense programs at the Heritage Foundation. How are you doing, Colonel? It's a pleasure to have you on the program, and thank you for your service.
Well, what an honor to be with you and to talk about such an important topic. So thanks for having me on the show.
So how are we doing? How is our military today? Because, you know, Donald Trump made the point as he came in that it had been run into the ground by previous administrations, and he wanted to restore it as much as possible. Tell me how he did, and tell me how the military is doing, and what we need to get back to where we ought to be for this modern world.
Right. So in a short period of time, he made really good progress, but we need longer time, the same sort of focus. So it's actually a 30-year story. Collapse of the Soviet Union, nobody really does anything with the military in the 1990s, shrinks to half the size that it was when we were fighting the Soviets or, you know, pushing against them. We have the September 11th attacks, and then the military is fully focused on counterterrorism operations and counterinsurgency in Afghanistan and Iraq. So we run them ragged for like 15 years, and the defense budgets were paying for that current operational posture, you know, gas and bullets and bombs and blown up vehicles and all those sorts of things. So making it new or replacing old stuff bought in the 80s with new stuff that is relevant to today's battlefield was just ignored. So when Trump came into office, his team saw the condition of the military, said we can't dramatically expand it, very expensive, not enough time, but at least we can make what we have combat ready. And so the last 3 years or so have really been focused on improving the readiness of our current force. The bigger lift is going to be how do you get it larger, which it needs to be, and how do you really modernize it with all the new tools that it needs?
Okay, so just replacing what we, you know, basically wore out or threw away. I mean, not threw away, but we used it. And the equipment was designed to be used. That's not going to be enough. We have to make a physically larger force. And Colonel, I know there are going to be people out there saying, but we're a modern, you know, the world has changed some.
Right.
And there's certainly tools that are still useful today. And there are tools that maybe we have to rethink how we take things on. But what have we got now? About 2.1 million in all active duty and reserve serving in uniform right now?
Yeah, roughly that's about it. But a lot of that is back kind of back office. You know, it's the Marines and sailors and soldiers and airmen that make the operational component what it is. And so when you look at the size of the world, that hasn't changed. In the Cold War, we had one competitor to the Soviet Union. Today, we've got Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. So you got more capable actors, and these actors, these countries have more advanced systems. So the average age of a fighter plane used by the Air Force is 30 years old. Nobody drives a 30-year-old car. Over half of the ships in the U.S. Navy are greater than 20 years old. You know, these things were bought 20, 25, 30 years ago. So we've used the equipment that we bought two or three decades ago at a very high level of employment because of current operations. So is the equipment good? Well, when you're going against terrorists with no Navy, no armor, no Air Force, we can do whatever we want to. But if you go up against a China who has 350 ships already compared to our 300, they're building their third aircraft carrier. They have land-based anti-ship cruise missiles that are actually state-of-the-art. That's a different kind of fight. So the Air Force today is less than half the size it was back in the late 1980s, early 1990s. And, you know, it's just modern technology goes on. We don't use 2-pound cell phones anymore. You know, you got your little pocket device. Modern cars today are just more sophisticated, more fuel efficient, more effective than something you would have bought 40 years ago. So I think we take our daily experiences and we apply those to the military, and you have a better understanding of what our young men and women have been using for the last 20 years. So we just really need to equip them properly.
Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood is with me from Heritage. So let's, since we have a short period of time, mm-hmm. what would it cost over, say, the next decade or two? Because you said this is a long-run kind of thing we have to do. What would it cost over 10 years or 20 years to bring us up to what would be appropriate to meet the challenges that we're up against today?
It has to be a slow, gradual build over time. If you wrote a blank check to the defense industry, you know, making tanks, ships, or whatever, they couldn't spend that. You just don't have the people trained, you know, the production lines. It just can't happen overnight. But you probably heard this 3 to 5% above the rate of inflation.
Yep.
That is an increase, you know, the rate of inflation. Give me 3% more than that on a regular basis for the next 10 years, and it's a sustained gradual climb, you know, like climbing any kind of hill or road, right? Instead of going vertical, you'd much rather take something that you can handle. So it's that kind of rate. Today, we spend about 3% of GDP on the defense budget. Back in the Cold War days, for half a century, we spent 5%. That was average or normal. So we have gotten used to very low levels of funding that was effective because of the type of enemy that you were engaging. If you go up against a big country, you need Cold War level sorts of forces and the funding that goes with that. So $700 billion, huge amount of money, only 3% of the budget. It's below the rate of inflation. If you went to 5% on the $20 trillion economy, it's about $1 trillion. I don't think we need that much. But that would be below historical averages. And folks just haven't been explained, you know, that that's the reality. And so any government coming into office is going to have to better do a better job of explaining to the taxpayer what we need, what it costs, and how long it's going to take to get there.
All right, Colonel, let me ask you this. Are there places where we could say, well, these tools really worked well back then, but they don't work well at all today, and there are places where we can find some of the savings? I'm not saying don't increase the overall budget. Are there some efficiencies we can find there if we actually listen to what the military says it needs?
You have to be more focused on the type of enemy and the environment that you're going to fight in instead of having a generalized force that is kind of good in a lot of areas. So the Marine Corps is dramatically refashioning itself. It says, look, if we're going to go up and serve the country, we have to be able to fight in a very contested environment against China. If we can do that, we can fight anywhere. That's a maritime environment, lots of islands and atolls and those things. They say tanks don't work there. So the Marine Corps is actually getting rid of all of its tanks, all of its heavy bridging units, getting rid of a lot of its old tube artillery, you know, that you would normally see on a battlefield, so that it can shift those resources to new types of equipment that are relevant and effective. So I think it's a brilliant move on their part. The Army has a different kind of fight, you know, much longer ranges. It needs longer range rockets instead of standard artillery. It needs vehicles that are more nimble instead of an 80 or 90 ton tank. So firepower or mobile protected firepower is what they would call that in a different form. But modern sensors and modern anti-platform weapons are so good that you just can't fly a 1980 vintage airplane into somebody else's airspace and expect not to get shot down.
Colonel, keep up the good work at Heritage, and it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails, but they're certainly welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you can answer our Twitter poll both on Twitter at Lars Larson Show or on our website at LarsLarson.com if you don't like Twitter. And there are so many of us who don't like Twitter these days. You know, I've told you that I've been working remotely most of this year, and I don't have a problem with it, but I know that it can be a real trial for some people, although to some extent, a lot of big companies are deciding that working remotely is something that is not only good for the employee, but it's also good for the employer and perhaps puts less wear and tear on the infrastructure, you know, highways and police services and all the rest of that. I thought we'd talk with Brent Orell about this from the American Enterprise Institute. He's one of the smart guys there. Mr. Orell, welcome back to the program. And is working remotely the new normal for a large number of Americans? And what kinds of difficulties do you think we can expect to see if people start to do this as the new normal?
Yeah, well, it's certainly the new normal for a lot more people than it used to be. Prior to the COVID crisis, we were at about 7% of the workforce working remotely. That is somewhere around 30% now, and that's a huge change in a very short period of time. I think that there was a lot of hesitation among employers to permit or encourage remote work out of fears over supervision, productivity, and other kinds of business concerns, which are rational, they're logical. But a lot of those concerns just haven't been borne out. We see growth in productivity. We see businesses doing very well with remote workforces. And so I think that side of the equation, I think employers are just a lot more comfortable with remote work than they were before COVID. It's always been popular among employees. People like that flexibility. They like not commuting a couple hours a day to get into their offices and back home. It's been mostly, I think, a win-win for employers and employees. But it's early days. This is a massive social experiment that we're undergoing right now that we've never had before. And I think it's going to take a long time for it to play out and for us to get a better handle on what the actual long-term impacts are.
Mr. Rell, by the way, thanks for that great answer. But tell me this, if next year, if the advent of this vaccine, which is already rolling out in Great Britain, it's rolling out in Canada, we expect to see it roll out perhaps with approval, very soon. If that is a game changer and effectively ends the pandemic or takes it down to a, you know, much, much lower level where it just becomes one more disease that Americans have to take account of, would you expect most of this change to remote work to stick? Or do you think there's going to be pressure for whatever reason, economically or otherwise, for employers to say, okay, you all have to come back to the office now?
Yeah, I actually think a lot of it probably will stick, in large part because I think that there's some significant cost savings to employers to a remote workforce. They can shrink their commercial real estate footprint. Doesn't mean that the offices go away entirely. I don't think that's going to happen. But I do think there's an economic incentive for allowing those workers for whom remote work is a good fit in terms of what they do in their jobs to continue doing that. It increases resiliency for business operations. It reduces costs, reduces impact, as you mentioned in the introduction, on infrastructure, reduces environmental impact. There's a whole bunch of benefits to remote work. There are also downsides, and I think those downsides for both employers and employees, we need to pay attention to those.
What are the biggest downsides that you can see, other than sort of the obvious ones? You mentioned supervision and productivity, but if you know you're working, say, in an insurance office or a legal office, and there's a certain output you're expected to do, if you maintain that output, it can be measured. Yeah. And if you're aware that, you know, it's not just your smiling face or your charming personality that keeps the boss happy, but that he actually expects, he or she expects, that you will produce a certain amount of work, and you stop doing it, in some ways, working remotely, it's going to be more apparent. You're going to be the lawyer who says, I expect my legal assistants to churn out this many briefs a week, and you're churning out half that number. Either explain it, or we may find somebody else to work in that job. I think you'd be much more aware that you're going to be judged on metrics more than, as I said, your smiling personality.
Right. Although we shouldn't discount the smiling personality side of this. And that really goes to the question of how remote work impacts work culture. Work is more than, you know, human beings are more than widgets. They do other things. There's a lot of innovation and corporate culture, business culture that gets created by in-person contact that is not easily replicated, I think, on Zoom or some other electronic platform. You just think about it in your own life. I mean, the conversations that you have walking to and from meetings or by the water cooler or going to lunch, a lot of business gets transacted informally inside businesses. And that's, I see, as kind of the major downside to remote work, is that it can, I think, really sap both the culture of a place. How do you introduce new employees to a business when that business isn't in a particular place? And I think it also interferes with that kind of informal innovation that occurs in businesses. I don't think productivity is going to be the problem per se, for the reasons that you pointed out. I think it's pretty easy to monitor, whether an employee is producing or not.
Let me throw one other thing into you, and you haven't mentioned this, but I don't know that there's a way to actually put a number to it, but right now in American workplaces, or before the arrival of the China virus, there was the problem. Somebody says something that offends somebody else. Somebody, you know, and those kind of things go on all the time, and they've become a big legal minefield. Not just, you know, they're all HR complaints and things like that. Do a lot of those go away if you have, say, 30% of your workforce working remotely, where they're effectively in a position where they can't make those kinds of foolish errors?
Well, I think you'd probably want to consult with Jeffrey Toobin on that question.
Jeffrey Toobin got caught having fun in a Zoom meeting, in a way in which he was entertaining himself to keep it a family show. And his coworkers saw some of this self-entertainment, and he got fired for it.
Right. So, I mean, I suppose in some ways it modifies behavior questions, like, you know, the inappropriate touch, the inappropriate, whistle in the hallway, or, you know, whatever it is. Maybe remote work takes care of some of that, but you can have just as many conflicts and bad behavior over an electronic platform as you can in person. Human nature, remote work doesn't change human nature, human behavior, in that particular way.
Well, I can see that, although I think everybody's aware, when you call the airlines, or used to call the airlines, and they'd say all calls will be monitored for quality assurance. Those operators certainly know that. They know that everybody could go back and say, your operator treated me disrespectfully, and the boss can listen to it. So I guess if you're only communicating with, or mostly communicating with, your coworkers by electronic means, you're also aware there's an electronic trail of everything you said and all the communications that you made. Brent Arel, thank you very much. Brent is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and remote work, It's not everything to every company, but I have a feeling it's going to stick as well. And the changes in America's workforce are going to be permanent. Glad to have you with me. 866-439-5277. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. You know, earlier this year, we had doctors telling us it's going to be a year and a half, 2 years, maybe long, could be 5 years before we see a vaccine. And then came the Operation Warp Speed from the Trump administration, and we got a vaccine, actually multiple vaccines, in record time, far less than even the shortest predictions that I'd ever heard. And then we heard, well, you know, it's, yeah, but it's going to take some time to get it out there. It's getting out there right now. So I thought we'd put a couple of questions about the vaccine that's out there now to Dr. Kevin Pham, who's a medical doctor and also visiting policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. Dr. Pham, welcome back.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me back.
Is there any practical difference between the Moderna vaccine that doesn't yet have approval, although it appears to be on the cusp of it, and the Pfizer shots that are already out there?
The practical differences for your average American, probably not the same. They have the same efficacy ratings, about 95%. And they use the same technology, too. So even biophysiologically, it should function exactly the same way. The main difference is sort of logistical, and it's that the Moderna vaccine does not require that extra cold transportation that the Pfizer one does. The Pfizer one requires a far below zero transportation.
What is it, 70 to 95 degrees below zero? So they've got to transport it in special containers and special trucks, and it has to stay that way till you thaw it out, and then it's got a relatively short shelf life?
Yeah, exactly. It has some special transportation requirements and handling requirements. And so it's good that it's out there, but I think once the Moderna vaccine gets out there too, it's going to make it a lot easier to reach, harder to reach places. And I think having both of these two vaccines working in conjunction will really help us get to a large portion of the population vaccinated.
I'm curious about something. This vaccine came about because of some money that was put into the federal government, I think in total put in about $9 billion to incentivize some of these big pharma companies to go out and develop a vaccine. I mean, imagine being a company that spends, you know, the better part of the year and a bunch of money and time and effort and everything else, and then finds out, well, we didn't come up with a vaccine. Okay, too bad. Well, you know, that would be the kind of thing that a profit-making company would not want to do. So the money pumped in by the government, while I'm not a big fan of federal government subsidies or state government subsidies, did seem appropriate in this case. But what seemed crazy to me is Europe isn't paying its share on this vaccine. They're getting it for 24% less than the people in the country where the vaccine was developed with the help of taxpayer money. As a policy analyst at Heritage, do you have an opinion on that? Why are we giving the Europeans a special deal and making Americans pay full rate?
Well, it doesn't seem fair, and that's because it's not fair. And the truth of it is that life's not fair. But you know what? If it takes American ingenuity and tax dollars to get this vaccine in less than a year, then, you know, I'm fine with sticking an American flag in that one. I think our flag will fly high on there.
So we'll just give a gift to our European friends for nothing, right?
You know, essentially. But this wouldn't be the first time that America has helped out the European continent. Not even the second time.
No, it's not. I keep wondering when is going to be the, you know, when are they going to turn around and help us? But let me move on to another issue. I've heard about some allergic reactions that people have had to this vaccine, and it's relatively new. There haven't been that many people vaccinated now. I don't know if the numbers are in the tens of thousands now or even past 100,000, but we've already heard about some reactions that people are having. Should we be concerned about that?
I would say for the vast majority of people who receive the vaccine, we're talking 99%+. There has not been a serious reaction like that. Looking at the study, so there's two things. There's we've been hearing about this Bell's palsy thing. I think it was a reported 4 people developed it, but that's a transient reaction. If it was even considered related to the vaccine, it's hard to say. And that's 4 people out of 20,000 people who received the vaccine, the actual vaccine, as opposed to a placebo. So 4 out of 20,000 is a very small number. And in the study itself, it didn't report Bell's palsy as an adverse event. But there were also four adverse events. One of which seems to be just an injury from the actual injection. So really, it was three that may be related to the vaccine itself.
An injury from the injection? Yeah. They stuck the needle in too hard, or what?
That's what it seems like. There's not a detailed note on that, but yeah, essentially, either three or four adverse events were recorded that were related to serious adverse events that were related to the vaccine. So again, that's a very tiny number. There is going to be a much larger percentage of people who develop sort of cold-like symptoms, either fevers and chills, or just and a lot of people will experience injection site pain and swelling. That's fairly normal. About half of the people in the vaccine group reported these things.
Okay.
So that's normal. That's to be expected.
Well, and that's not anything. And by the way, this is not a vaccine made from a dead virus or an attenuated virus. This isn't being made from the virus at all. It's using mRNA, and people are concerned about that as well. Can you address that, Dr. Pham?
Yeah, sure. People hear genetic material, and they think that it's going to alter our DNA. That's really not what it does. The mRNA is sort of a transcript that's used. It's sort of like a scantron that you insert into a machine called a ribosome, and that uses the mRNA to develop the proteins. And so this is viral mRNA, and it develops the protein that that is used in the shell of the virus. So as the body develops these, then it also develops antibodies to these proteins. So when the real virus comes along, the antibodies will be available, and it will start to attack the virus as it shows up.
Dr. Kevin Pham is at the Heritage Foundation. Dr. Pham, it's a pleasure to have you on. I'll get back to you and your phone calls and your emails coming up next on The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails. You know, I've always been proud of the United States of America. I accept the fact that every single country out there, every human enterprise is going to have its flaws. But it seems that these days, when your kids go off to that government-funded school, and that's assuming they still can go to an actual bricks-and-mortar classroom, or when they log on for online virtual school, they're being fed a line that says, your country is bad. It's been bad since before it was a country. Going all the way back to 1619, and it has to pay for its sins today. If you're surprised by that, you need to pay attention to what's going on in the classroom where your child is going to school, whether the classroom is a virtual one in your home or whether it's an actual bricks and mortar somewhere. David Davenport is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution and a visiting scholar at the Orrin Hatch Foundation. David, good to have you back on the program.
Thank you, Lars. Good to be with you.
So we can get to the part of this being incorporated in classrooms in a moment, because I want you to hit that. But what are the flaws of what the New York Times called the 1619 Project? And why is it that the paper, having invested so much in the way of time and resources into something, would have a flawed product that even they today admit is flawed? And they know about the flaws, and I think they should have known about it when they published it or before they published it.
Well, it was really an attempt by the Times to say that the starting point for American history should not be the Constitution and the Declaration, which, of course, we've always taught and believed, but it should go back to the year that the first slaves arrived from Africa onto our territory. So in a sense, what they were trying to say is the founding of the country was when we had an economic system, a farming system that included slaves. And included what I would call the original sin of slavery, paraphrasing them, and that hasn't worked out very well, because I think people understand that the real founding of the country was when we declared our independence of other countries 150 years later, and when we adopted our Constitution. What makes America unique and distinctive is our constitutional system of government. So it hasn't played very well to try to restate the founding of the country, but it's led to quite a debate.
Well, and what was the advantage, from the New York Times point of view, to redefining when the country started and defining a country as simply a group of people in the same geography who are involved in some kind of commerce and doing things that by today's standards are evil? Slavery is an evil, but it has apparently existed. I mean, anybody who's read history knows that there's been slavery virtually everywhere on Earth for some period of time. And then, in fact, slavery still exists in some parts of the planet today, doesn't it?
Well, sure. But I think a lot of what the Times was trying to do was to say that the real essence of America is its economic system. It's not its constitutional system, but it's the economy, stupid. And they're trying to get us to focus on economic injustice and economic inequality and unfair treatment of slaves and so forth, which of course are all issues worth discussing. But that's not what the United States of America is about. The United States of America was founded by a constitution and by freedom and by the Declaration of Independence. So. I think it's an attempt to redefine us as a constitutional republic into just an economic system. And it gets into the whole debate about socialism versus capitalism and all that sort of thing. So I think they were really trying to change the debate and to try to change people's understanding of what makes America special. And in the end, I don't think that's going to work.
No, it's not. And defining us as simply, look, if you look at the Constitution, if you look at individual rights, and if you say we have a Constitution that says the government can't take my life, liberty, or property without due process and just compensation, it assumes, I guess, a capitalist system where the government doesn't own everything. So some of those assumptions are built into those documents, but the Constitution and the Declaration go well far beyond that, don't they?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the Declaration, you know, starts out by, reaffirming our God-given rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so it's that which I think permeates everything about America. Freedom permeates our economic system. It's part of our spiritual, religious system. We're free to worship the God we want, not to attend the Church of England. We're free politically, we're free from government interference, undue government interference. So that's really the essence of America, and it's in the first sentence of the Declaration of Independence. You need, in a sense, look no further than that.
So how did this come to be incorporated into the curriculum of small children in public schools?
Well, that's a fair point. Really, that's been happening for quite a while. I think we may have even spoken about this in the past, but there's been quite a movement, certainly since the 1960s, and it's accelerated certainly in 2020. There's been an effort by some liberal historians and scholars to redefine what America is about. And the leading, unfortunately, textbook by Howard Zinn, A People's History of the United States,
oh God!
Which was at first, I know, it was at first sort of an alternative understanding of American history, and now it's even mainstream. I mean, it's sold millions of copies and is used in both high school and college classrooms extensively. And Zinn basically rewrites history from American history from the standpoint of what he calls the victims. So the story of Columbus was not about discovering a new territory. It was about robbing and killing Indians and getting gold. And founding the country was not about the Constitution, but it was about the founders, you know, protecting their slave interests through the different laws that they passed and the different provisions they put in the Constitution. And World War II was not about helping other countries and stopping fascism and Nazism and its spread, but it was about capitalist domination of other countries and so forth. So it's a whole rewriting of American history, and it's been a problem in our schools for a long time. My daughter studied Zen in American history and would have to come home for me and have conversations with me to kind of get her brain turned back around.
So is there any way to get the public schools, for the people listening to this, the first question they're going to ask me, and it's a reasonable one, is how do we get our public schools to say this is not the kind of thing that we ought to be teaching kids, that they should reimagine America as simply a bunch of people, a bunch of money-grubbing people who are going after something, and that everything they've ever learned about America before, about freedom, about liberty, about self-government, about a republic, if you can keep it, ma'am, that all of that should be thrown out, and we should just view this as one giant commercial enterprise that steamrolls over anybody and everybody in its way?
Yeah, I would give brief answers to your very good question, Lars. First of all, politically, the good news is that American K-12 education is still basically a state and local matter. The federal influence which got stronger, actually, under the No Child Left Behind law 20-plus years ago. That law was not renewed. Another law took its place.
David Davenport, research fellow at the Hoover Institution and a visiting scholar at the Orrin Hatch Foundation. David, thanks so much for your time. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I always admit if I have a dog in the fight, and obviously on the First Amendment, I've got a deliberate bias in favor of First Amendment free speech rights and not having the government get in the way of those rights. So I'm biased in favor of free speech, but I would think most Americans would be biased in favor of free speech. And then along comes a study done by the Tommy Thompson Center on Public Leadership and Professor Ryan Owens, who is the Edwards Professor of American Politics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, found out some interesting things in that survey. Professor Owens, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So tell me about this. Did you expect the kind of results that this survey showed up, that a majority, sometimes even a sizable majority, of students actually want the government to put limits on free speech?
Well, was I surprised by it? In some respects, yes. In some respects, no. I mean, we've seen an increasing amount of intolerance, I think, across the country, particularly among younger people of a progressive tilt. And, so that didn't really surprise me. But the degree to which I think some of these First Amendment protections are under attack was somewhat surprising to me. I mean, the fact that, you know, 40%, roughly 40% of students believe that the government should restrict the speech of climate change deniers. That's a little frightening. Some of the other results, it's frightening.
You know, it's funny, Professor, because I didn't finish college. I went to college for a while, and that was a long, long time ago. But I was always told that college campuses were places where you'd be exposed to a broad range of ideas, some of which contradict each other, but that was the beauty of it. And now it sounds as though college campuses have turned into maybe a fancier version of the re-education camps of Cambodia, where there's one point of view, and if you don't adopt that point of view, then you're going to find yourself getting terrible grades, maybe even getting thrown out or being brought up on disciplinary charges, and that's at the campus level. And that goes through to the students who then say, well, we should take everyone who disagrees on this subject and simply what? Make them drink hemlock?
Yeah. Well, I think the fact that, you know, people heard college as a place where you go to have your horizons expanded, well, that was in an environment where people were going to public schools that were still, moderate or conservatives. And sure, you'd be exposed to different views when you go to college because, you know, you'd be pressed with liberal, propaganda. Look, I think we've got a real problem in this country. The goal, and on college campuses, the goal here is not to make it easy for people to say stupid and hateful things. I think, you know, we all hope for a time when people will not say insensitive and harmful comments like this.
Agreed.
Rather, what we're interested in is this long-run, effects here. Do we want government telling us what to think, what to say, how to pray? And I'm convinced that the answer to that is not, because we know historically that government, when it has the power to do that, will snuff out people's rights and liberties without second thought.
Well, and I agree with you. And this is where these are students wishing that the government do it. And at the University of Wisconsin, which is a public institution, right? So it's to some extent held to the First Amendment limitations. I always explain to my audience, the First Amendment is a limit on government. It's not a limit on the private sector. So if you go to a private university and they say, you know, everybody who goes to school here has to remain chaste, I think there are still a couple of universities that do that. They have the freedom to do that. You couldn't do that at a public university, but to have public universities where these kinds of ideas are endorsed is just crazy. 50% of the students believe that government should restrict speech of racially insensitive people. Well, I guess it sounds good on paper if you say, well, we shouldn't use the N-word. I say, okay, then you're going to have to throw out an awful lot of Samuel Clemens work. You can't read that. Now, you certainly can't read it aloud. And you can't have, but it also means that if I say, I think we ought to enforce America's immigration laws, I've been told with great authority by some of my callers, you're being racially insensitive. And I said, I'm talking about enforcing laws. And they say, yeah, but the laws are racial. I said, no, they're not racial. They say, if you want to come to America, ask permission from the government, and a million people a year get it. Well, that's still racially insensitive because that has a negative effect predominantly on Hispanic people, making it so in other words, you can define almost anything as racially insensitive.
I think that's right. And look, the broader point here is, You know, and I got to tell you, I've caught a bunch of flack over the last 2 days for this. It's infuriating.
I'll bet.
You know, you get people who say, well, you didn't ask the question correctly, or, you know, you're not understanding the nuances of what's involved with the law here. It's like, look, people, understand the big picture here. We've got a problem. We've got intolerance creeping into our society, and it's making us less safe. It's making us more polarized, and we've got to do something about it. Now, we can do a little bit at the university level. At the end of our report, we talk a little bit about how campuses might require students to take First Amendment training so that when they're done, they can be better citizens, have a stronger awareness of what's permissible and what's not. We can give them more training when they come into universities. But I think really what these results show is that at the K-12 level, we've got to double down our efforts. Students are coming into universities with these thoughts in their heads already.
Yeah, because they're getting them, I think, out of public schools. I mean, some of them may have got those ideas out of their public education, but many of them, and some may get them from their parents. But the idea that we should punish people, and then one of the poll questions you asked was that you should revoke the invitation to speakers who had come to a campus who say something that might offend somebody. Well, you know, to me, the idea of talking about killing unborn babies is offensive. And I think that right. point of view is shared, you know, generally by about half the population of the United States, maybe even better than half. You know, because if you say, should we outlaw it altogether, you get a pretty solid no. If you say, should we have it available for any reason at any time for anyone, period, you usually get a no to that. But somewhere in the middle is okay, there are people who believe that abortion should be available, but not all the time under all circumstances. And there are people who say, and there are extremists at both ends of that one as well. But if you say, you know, this woman is in favor of protecting unborn life, well, that's offensive. You know, don't allow her on campus or him on campus. That's crazy, right? I think.
Yeah, it is. And look, I mean, we've had faculty members here in the University of Wisconsin who would tell their students that abortion is a human right. And, you know, that's permissible from a faculty perspective. But, you know, to have somebody come out and talk about a pro-life agenda, you know, you can imagine what response they might get. You know, these results are troubling. And look, even if somebody wants to nitpick with one question here or there, you didn't, you know, have enough nuance in it or something like that, I think the overall tenor of the results that we obtain here are troubling and should be troubling for everyone.
Okay, before we run out of time, let me ask you this. Are the universities you have boards of trustees, or they may operate under different names, but, you know, basically the board of directors of the university. These are people generally drawn from the community. They're often very significant people or substantial people with good backgrounds. Are any of them pushing back against the idea that college campuses are now seen by conservatives, at least, as simply liberal indoctrination centers?
So I think most of the regents at our university are aware of that. They recently passed another policy statement that tells the universities within the UW system that they cannot engage in sort of ideological indoctrination. But there really hasn't been much of an effort, as far as I can tell yet, to enforce that policy, perhaps because they're not aware of the extent to which it is a problem. So we've sent the results of this survey to them, to the system campuses, and we'll see what happens. I'm hopeful that the university does the right thing here, recognizes that it has a problem and works to resolve it. You know, I'm not going to hold my breath, but we at least have to give them the opportunity to try to take care of it.
That is Professor Ryan Owens. By the way, the study was done at the Tommy Thompson Center on Public Leadership. It found that 50% up to 2/3 of students believe the government should punish hate speech and silence opposing points of view. We'll be back in a moment. 866-439-5277. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. Should any state, should any community look at the world through the lens of race, and what happens when we do? Well, the perfect guy to talk to about that is our friend Mike Gonzalez, senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation and the author of The Plot to Change America, How Identity Politics is Dividing the Land of the Free. Mike, I was just sharing with my audience that there are literally programs that have been set up during this pandemic this last year that say you don't qualify unless you have the right skin color. Something I thought went out with all of the debates over, you know, drinking fountains and seats at the diner and seats on board buses, that we had all agreed you can't have race-based thinking when it comes to deciding how the government treats its various citizens. Or can we?
Well, Lars, hi, how are you? First of all, let me thank you for
welcome having... back, by the way.
Yeah, thank you. Look, you said a whole bunch of things. Let me try to address a couple of them. You're absolutely right that what is being tried here, and I think Americans, your listeners, but all Americans, you have to have their eyes very open to this, is a return to the Plessy era, a return to the Plessy versus Ferguson era introduced in the late 1880s, early 1890s, that says, yes, we can have separate but equal. No, we cannot. You know, to treat the races differently was evil then. It produced 100 years, almost 100 years of Jim Crow, which was evil. And we should have moved away. Unfortunately, well, you know, with the civil rights movement, which was what was necessary to move away from Jim Crow, right away we jumped into another kind of race consciousness, another kind of color consciousness. And now to refer to what is happening under COVID is that you're absolutely right. The leaders of the Marxist organization, the Black Lives Matter organization, which are Marxists, and not the concept, I have to say this every time, you have to be deranged not to agree with the concept of Black Lives Matter. But the organizations are led by Marxist women, Marxist-Leninist women. They are very open about the fact that they want to use the pandemic to change the country. This is their opportunity to have a reset. So, yes, they're going to – this is a conflation of two things, the instability, the protests, the violence, and the riots that we had this year together with the pandemic to really rush into a transformation of America. You're absolutely right.
Well, and I'm very concerned about this. In fact, let me bring up a couple of specific issues. One, the BLM cry to defund the police, to empty the prisons, to say, let's no longer have people prosecuted for crimes, and if they already have been, release them from prison. I'm not going to argue that America hasn't had injustices of one kind or another, usually involving a very small number of people. But if you say, no, at this point, we don't want people arrested anymore, and especially if they make the case that says black people are and black males in particular, are arrested at a far higher percentage than they represent in the general population. You say, but if we're applying the law, and if somebody breaks the law, do we say if we get past a certain percentage of arrests of one, you know, one demographic or another, that we have to just stop arresting people? Because that doesn't make any sense. And I would argue that the biggest victims of that kind of policy would be black Americans themselves, who are too often, usually, the victims of those criminals.
Well, you're absolutely right. It's impoverished communities that would suffer the most. When the rich are always going to be okay, Lars. The rich are always going to be able to buy their own security. It's the impoverished communities that are going to suffer the most. Now, you know, you can make the case, and Heritage has made this case for years, that we're over-criminalized, right? That the lobstermen and fisher in Maine, yeah. Lobster fishermen in Maine are being put in prison for you know, netting lobsters that are, you know, 2 centimeters too long or too short.
And I agree with you there. But Mike, if all we're talking about, if we're primarily talking about people being sent to prison, you know, those are the kinds of things I'd love to see stripped off the law books. But if we're talking about the conventional crimes that have been crimes since the Ten Commandments, you can't murder people. You can't go out and beat on people. You can't steal from people. Those are the crimes that put most of the people behind bars, aren't they?
No, I was just setting the stage for that.
Sorry about that,
Mike. Stage for that. Is that yes, we do have, and Heritage has led with this. You know, Attorney General Ed Meese has been one of the leading lights, Reagan's Attorney General, in saying we're over-criminalized. But that is not what is at stake here. And by the way, I think you and I both agree that an 18-year-old or a 19-year-old or a 17-year-old who gets caught for smoking a joint or having some marijuana should not receive a life sentence in the sense that he goes to the slammer for a few months, but then nobody's going to hire him. Nobody's going to hire him for life.
And I would agree with you on that.
Yeah, no, we have to fix all that, right? But that is not what is at stake here. You're absolutely right in going back to crimes that have been crimes since the Bible, you know, crimes against our rights, you know, our right to life, our right to property. Those crimes, people have to serve time. But by the way, let me just go back to this because I'm writing a lot about this. Black Lives Matter, defunding the police and dismantling the police department, as bad as that is, and that is awful, 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 they're much worse than that because they're asking to smash capitalism. They want to transform all aspects of society, all our institutions, our structures, in our systems. They want to change them. So it's not just the police. You and I can have another argument about public sector unions, about police unions and teachers' unions. That's not what they want to have. They want a complete wholesale transformation.
Yeah, and if they do that, again, who suffers the most? And then let me bring up the vaccine, because we're right on the cusp of seeing a vaccine approved. And if a vaccine is approved, I'm hearing people say, well, let's give it to the people who need it the most. And you say, okay, let's talk about old people in nursing homes. Let's talk about older Americans, period, whether they're in nursing homes or not, the staff who work there, the staff who work at hospitals and clinics and doctor's offices. And I'm not for forcing it on anybody. But what I'm hearing as well is an undertone of let's play the race card and say there are historically disadvantaged communities and they ought to get it first. In other words, America, and I'm speaking of one state in particular, but there are states out there saying, let's make sure that we start to hand it out on the basis of race as well, which I don't think makes any sense. And it doesn't sound constitutional.
Right. No, it would be unconstitutional. And the principle with these things should always be, let's try to save the most lives possible with the limited resources that we have. That is the, let's try to, human lives, right? Both, all of us have a common humanity. Let's try to save as many lives as possible. And by the way, this thing with COVID is very interesting, right? Because all the categories they created, for example, the Hispanic category or the Asian American category they created back in the 70s, now they're coming up with COVID. They say, well, they're not real because Hispanics come from all different races and have all different cultures. And since what affects the, you know, health is either your DNA or your culture, what you eat, your habit, or what you've inherited, Hispanics doesn't help at all. To say that you're Hispanic means absolutely
it's an
zero.
Ethnicity, right?
Right. It's a made up category. Made up by OMB, by the Office of Management and Budget. Yeah, they call it ethnicity. Asian Americans, people come, Americans with backgrounds in India, backgrounds in Japan, backgrounds in Thailand, Vietnam. And these Americans have very different cultural indicators. Again, different inherited traits, different inherited adversities, adversity to a disease in different cultures. That's all that affects your health. So the chickens are really going to come home to roost for these created categories, because they're not going to be helpful at all in administering a vaccine.
No, they're not. Mike Gonzalez at Heritage, the author of The Plot to Change America, How Identity Politics is Dividing the Land of the Free. Mike, thanks so much. I appreciate the time. Your calls and your emails coming up. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Always glad to get your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. I'm an unabashed partisan for President Donald Trump, and I don't do that just instinctually. I believe that he is the best president for this country, and he is the best president of the 21st century, certainly better than the man he replaced. But one of the promises of the Biden-Harris, or if you want to be more accurate, Harris-Biden presidential team from the Democrat Party, is they promise to put a lot more government in your health care and take away an awful lot of the choice that you have as an American citizen. Most Americans are covered by private health insurance. There's a big chunk of government, as in the VA, Medicare, and Medicaid. But would the Harris-Biden presidency put Americans on that path to Medicare for all? Sally Pipes is the president and CEO of the Pacific Research Institute, and she specializes in this area. Sally, welcome back.
Thank you, Lars. It's a delight to be on a very important topic on the start of the Republican convention tonight.
Yeah, it is, because the president believes that the private sector does a better job, and I tend to agree with him. And yet, when you talk to Democrats about this, they say, oh, no, Medicare for all, that's not going to take the private sector out. It'll just mean it'll only be the government writing the check, and we're just going to cut all the private insurance companies out. I've heard that argument. Let's answer it directly.
Right, and we've heard that argument from Senator Bernie Sanders in his bills in 2017 and 2019. Kamala Harris signed on to both of them. But Medicare for All, and under Sanders' plan and most of the other, whether it's AOC or Pramila Jayapal from Washington State, completely ban any private coverage, and everybody would be left in a system that is run entirely by the government. And when people are polled, Kaiser Health News says 56% of people polled support Medicare for all. But when they're told that they would lose their private coverage, the support goes down to 37%. And when they're told that they would have to pay higher taxes for this program that would cost between $30 to $40 trillion over 10 years, support goes down to 27%.
And just so people understand, because when we get up to trillions, people say, well, what does that mean, trillions? But if you think about the federal government that now runs, I think, on about $4.5 trillion a year and growing, unfortunately, if you were to add $3 trillion a year to pay for Medicare for all, it would be adding 75% to the federal budget. Now, they say it would take the place of some Medicare, but the bottom line is you would be dramatically increasing the amount of taxes the federal government would have to collect to be able to pay for that. $3 trillion is almost three-quarters of what it costs to run the entire federal government right now, and that $3 trillion a year would be only the amount of money necessary to fund the medical side of this. That's an extraordinary sum of money.
Well, it is. And, you know, Bernie Sanders himself has said there would have to be new taxes, a new 7.5% payroll tax, a new 4% income tax on anyone earning over $29,000 a year. If you doubled all the corporate taxes and income taxes, it wouldn't be enough to pay for this program. And as a result, Lars, things would happen just like they do in Canada and the UK. Canada has a single-payer system. All private coverage is outlawed for anything considered medically necessary. And so you would get long waits for care and ration care because government wouldn't be able to afford to provide all of the care that is demanded by people when they think something is free.
But with a single payer, Betsy, and Sally, you help me sort this out. People say, but it's only the insurance side. The doctors and the nurses and the hospitals and the clinics, they'll still be private. But if they only have one company, one entity, the government that's paying the bill, the way the government saves money is they could then say, all right, doctors and hospitals, here's how much you will accept for, say, an office visit or for a particular procedure. And if the doctors and hospitals were treated that way by private health insurance companies, they'd say, well, we no longer take that private insurance. Why? Well, because they want to pay us $500 for a $1,000 procedure, and we can't afford to do that because we can't make the money back that we need to make back. A doctor might say, I'm not taking $100 for an office visit. An office visit with all the costs involved, both the doctor's salary, the clinic, his nurse, his bookkeeper, everybody else, that might be $175. I can't take $100 for an office visit. But if there's only one payer, the government can simply say, you will take $100 for an office visit. And I would predict that an awful lot of doctors and nurses will simply say, all right, I'm out of here. I'm leaving. I'll take my skills and talents. I can make better money somewhere else, and I won't be treated this way. That's the practical side. Even if you leave the doctors and the nurses and the hospitals and the clinics in private hands, if you only have one person writing the check, then the person writing the check can define what something is going to pay. Can't they?
Well, yes, exactly. And so in Canada, the hospitals are all owned by the government, by the provincial government. Doctors are private entities, but there's only one payer. Doctors are paid what the government decides they will be paid. Lars, you may be the very best neurosurgeon, I may be the very worst, but we would get the same because the pay is not merit-based. When your amount of money in your global budget runs out, if it runs out in November, the amount they've allocated for you, you can't do any more surgeries and get paid. And you know, Senator Sanders himself has said that in order to make this work, even with these tremendous tax increases, the fact is that doctors would have to be paid at Medicare rates, roughly 38% to 40% what they're paid below what they're paid now. This will have a tremendously negative impact on the best and brightest kids who go into medicine, and a lot of docs, I believe, will retire early from medicine. The Association of Medical Colleges has already predicted a shortage of 122,000 docs by 2032, and that's before a government takeover of our healthcare system. So it will be a disaster, and the quality of care will definitely decline.
That is Sally Pipes from the Pacific Research Institute.